Alright, welcome everyone to episode 34 of the Didactic Mind podcast. This is episode 34, The Civilizer and the Destroyer. Very warm welcome to all of my longtime readers, my SoundCloud subscribers, warm welcome to you as well. If you have not subscribed either to the blog or to the podcast, please make sure you do so now. That way you will never ever miss a new upload, and you can always be assured of getting notifications for both Didactic Mind and Domain Query podcasts. There should be another couple of Domain Queries actually coming this week, I think, because I had a few good questions on the blog and a few other places. And this week I wanted to talk about everybody's favorite subject, women. Because I think with everything that's going on politically and culturally, with the madness that has overtaken the West, it's easy to lose track of what is important in life and what truly matters. It's easy to think that we will never win out in the culture wars, and that we will always be faced with endless pain, misery, and suffering, and that the culture wars have most obviously and effectively damaged the most vulnerable among us, the children and of course the women. Well, that's all true, but it's important to understand and to keep things in perspective a little bit. To understand that women are the way they are, and that they are capable of both great good and great evil in a man's life. And it's important to have discernment to pick out which is which. Which is why the title of this podcast is The Civilizer and the Destroyer. Now, you won't often find me, as a Christian, talking about Hindu mythology, because I do not, I mean, my attitude towards Hinduism can be charitably described as one of deep skepticism. I have been around Hindus for pretty much most of my life, and I counted myself as an atheist for a long time. I said that I do not believe in any gods, Hindu or otherwise, for, oh, I don't know, 13, 15 years, something like that. But one of the concepts within Hinduism that is of interest is the notion of balance between creation, preservation, and destruction. Now, the Hindu trinity is very different from the Christian trinity. The Christian trinity isn't even mentioned in the Bible, actually, as we understand it. The Niceno-Constantinian Creed, which basically divides the person of God into the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that is not mentioned in the Bible. There are mentions of tripartite entities in the Bible, and that's true, but the doctrine of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that's extra-biblical. That is an invention that has, in all honesty, I think, distorted the message of Jesus Christ and of the Bible in general. But anyway, in Hinduism, the concept of the Divine Trinity comes down to Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Brahma, the creator, from whom all creation resulted. Vishnu, the preserver, who acts through his various avatars and incarnations to preserve the creation and to keep things in balance and harmony. And the destroyer, Shiva, who basically, I mean, depending on how you read the Hindu legends, will go on random rampages and destroy everything in his path, and when his third eye opens, which is in the middle of his forehead, then terrible things happen, and it's basically Ragnarok all over again. I mean, I'm being extremely uncharitable to Hindu teachings, but you know, the reality is that Hinduism and Christianity have absolutely nothing in common whatsoever, and it's important to understand that. I will make a brief digression here and talk about why that is, but let's be clear, the main point of this podcast is about women as civilizers and destroyers, and I'll get back to that. The reason why I say Hinduism and Christianity have absolutely nothing in common is because they don't. Hinduism as a religion is riven with contradictions and has no single set of scriptures. It's a very much a syncretic, do what you want, do as you will, follow these basic rules. You can't really convert into Hinduism. You can't really, supposedly, get out of Hinduism. If you're born a Hindu, then you're a Hindu for the rest of your life. It's, in all honesty, it's utterly contradictory, utterly self-absorbed. It's the definition of God as given in Hinduism is not God, a personal deity, a personal link to the creator of all things that we have in Christianity. The concept of God in Hinduism is a much less personal idea, which basically embodies the entirety of the universe. That's what it is. And if you don't believe me, I recommend that you read an article called The Gandhi Nobody Knew. Now, this is an article by a chap named Richard Grenier. It's in Commentary magazine, and it was written a long time ago, shortly after the release of the film Gandhi. And it goes into great detail about Gandhi's life, his beliefs, his internal self-contradictions, and so on. And it talks about Hinduism in the process, and talks about how Hinduism's own internal contradictions result in a completely messed up society from top to bottom. And, you know, having seen the results of that society, I completely agree with him. I know what he's talking about. I think he's absolutely right. Which is bound to offend a lot of Hindus, but look, I'm sorry, it's your country, you created it that way, it's a huge problem. It's riven with problems, sectarian tensions, lots of nonsense, religious bigotry, strife, so on. I'm sorry, that's your country, you created it, deal with the consequences. This is the result of your policies, your ideas, your faith, your culture, your backwardness, so, you know, just deal with it. I'm not saying that other countries are necessarily better or worse. I mean, objectively, there are many countries which are better, obviously, on a number of levels. But, you know, you could argue that if you look at Russia, for instance, Christian country for the last 1,000 years or thereabouts, ever since Prince Vladimir the Great converted the Kievan Rus to Christianity, it's been a Christian country ever since then. Well, you could argue that Russia has had plenty of problems with its social structure and its feudal outlook on life and so on, and that's true. I don't debate that. But the point that Richard Grenier makes in his article about Hinduism is that it leads to societal ossification and stagnation, and that because Hinduism is so shot through with internal contradictions, it cannot result in a stable society, or no, not a stable. Excuse me, that's wrong. Not a stable, it cannot result in a society that moves forward and pulls its people out of misery and poverty. The Hindu author of Indian descent, V.S. Naipaul, Knight of the British Empire, subject of the British Empire, and he's actually a British writer, but he was born in Trinidad and Tobago. And he wrote extensively about India and Hinduism from an extremely negative light. I mean, people I know have read his works, and they don't like what he has to say. They're like, he's incredibly negative about India, but he's never lived in India, and he's incredibly negative about Hinduism, but, you know, he himself is a Hindu. Well, yeah, I mean, so what? But V.S. Naipaul wrote quite a lot at great length about the deficiencies of Hinduism, and this is referenced in Richard Grenier's article at length. And Naipaul basically said that Hindus make dirt and excrement almost a holy thing, which is like, what are you talking about? But that's exactly what he said. He basically said, Hinduism, Naipaul writes, has given men no idea of a contract with other men, no idea of the state. It has enslaved one quarter of the population, which are the untouchables, and always has left the whole fragmented and vulnerable. Its philosophy of withdrawal has diminished men intellectually and not equipped them to respond to challenge. It has stifled growth, so that again and again in India, history has repeated itself. Vulnerability, defeat, withdrawal. And he goes on to say, Indian poverty is more dehumanizing than any machine, and more than in any machine civilization, men in India are units, locked up in the straitest obedience by their idea of their dharma, their fate or their duty, basically. The blight of caste is not only untouchability and the consequent deification in India of filth, his words, the blight in an India that tries to grow is also the overall obedience it imposes, the diminishing of adventurousness, the pushing away from men of individuality and the possibility of excellence. Very harsh words, but in my experience, very true. Now, coming back to the concept, the core concept in Hinduism that inspired all this, the idea of the creator, the preserver, and the destroyer, this is, again, not a Christian doctrine. It has no compatibility with Christianity. We do not believe in these things at all, and nor should we. But it's an interesting heuristic from an intellectual perspective, and that's all I want to look at it as. I hold no truck with it otherwise. I do not believe spiritually it makes any sense whatsoever. But be that as it may, having explicated all the faults of Hinduism, and there are many more, and I would, you know, happily go into them in a future podcast once I do some studying on the subject, because I am no expert in Hinduism and I don't much care for it. But that being said, it is worthy of study. What is it about this division into three pieces that is interesting in the frame of social-sexual relationships? Well, it all comes down to the way that a woman can affect a man. Now, a lot of red pill literature and thinking is focused around how important it is for a man to make something of himself. And that's true. That is 100% absolutely true. In this respect, red pill, masculinity, game, all of that stuff is fully compatible with Christianity. The fornication part is not. Let's be clear about this. The stuff about the literature from pickup artists about how to spew the right lines and have the right frame and look the right way for a woman and how to approach a woman and catch her attention and so on and so forth. That's all rooted in truth, in biomechanical and biological truths. But it's wrong from a Christian standpoint. It's just wrong, okay? You don't get to do that stuff the way you want to. It's not okay to fornicate with women. It's not even okay to be in a long-term relationship with a woman and not get married. I know I'm in one. This is why this is one of the reasons why I tell people, don't look to me as an example of Christian, you know, morality, because I'm not one. All right? Every single word that I say on the subject of Christianity should be looked at with deep skepticism. And every single thing I say on the subject should be analyzed and parsed and picked over for errors in thinking and problems in execution. I don't pretend to be perfect. In fact, I am such a failure in so many ways, it's not even funny. So anybody who looks to me as a role model should not. All right. I try to provide what advice I can, what insight I can, and hopefully some of it is actually good. I don't know. That's up to the listener or the reader to decide. But when it comes to women, the Bible is unequivocally clear about this. A good woman can be the making of a man. But the Bible is replete, chock full of instances of women who brought their men down and brought them low. And in this respect only, is there any kind of similarity, if you will, between what Hinduism says about the creator or the civilizer and the destroyer. In Hinduism, there is a goddess named Parvati, who is the consort of Shiva. And again, one of the reasons why Hinduism isn't compatible with Christianity, their main deities aren't exactly in monogamous, faithful relationships. There is a case to be made, again, another digression, I apologize for this. This is my way of speaking. I tend to chase rabbits down their holes pretty readily. But there is a case to be made. If you listen to my podcast from a while back, Who Watches the Watchers? There is a case to be made that the Watchers, the Nephilim, the sons, basically the sons of God, the angels, as it were, who came down to earth and found, not the fallen angels, to be clear, not the fallen ones, but angels created by God to watch over his creation, who found earth women to be attractive and beautiful, came down to earth and had sons and daughters through those women. And those sons and daughters, well, the sons are the ones mentioned in the Bible, became mighty men of great renown. That's actually the wording in the Bible, mighty men of great renown. There is a case to be made that those mighty men and their fathers are the demigods and the gods spoken of in, well, I mean, you name it, you know, Middle Eastern mythology, from Babylon, the Akkadians, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Mesopotamian cultures, all of them mention things of this nature. The Greek and Roman, eventually Roman, myths and legends concerning gods and demigods, I mean, fits in perfectly almost. And with respect to East Asian cultures as well. Han Chinese culture makes significant mention of gods and goddesses, and their mythology is much more confusing, but it's there. And Japanese culture as well. Indian culture, Hindu culture, is full of it. I mean, the gods and goddesses of Hindu culture line up pretty well with the very extremely brief description of gods and demigods, through the Watchers and the Nephilim given in the Bible. And I haven't read the Book of Enoch. I plan to at some point. But the Book of Enoch apparently goes into much more detail about the nature of the Watchers and what they did. And it's like, it's almost a one-to-one correspondence in some cases between the gods of other cultures and the Watchers. But the thing about these cultures is that they don't emphasize monogamy of any kind. According to Hindu culture, infidelity was introduced into the world depending on, you know, which interpretation or which set of scriptures or which mythology you take. Because again, Hinduism has no central, you know, single dogma, culture, whatever. There is no one interpretation to read a standard. Either it was Indra, the king of the gods, who, like, how is it the king of the gods isn't also the guy who created everything? You know, I don't get it, but anyway. He was the one who introduced infidelity into the world. And, or it was, you know, Vishnu or Brahma or somebody who, you know, did the same thing. But at any rate, Fidelity and monogamy are important in Hindu culture, but then infidelity is also implicitly kind of encouraged almost. I'm not saying it is encouraged, I'm saying it seems that way judging by the actions of the gods and goddesses. But at any rate, Shiva and Parvati are the kind of husband and wife or prince and consort or whatever of destruction. And Parvati, when she goes crazy for whatever reason, becomes Kali, the goddess of destruction. And she goes completely and totally apeshit, like berserk. And that's a nice illustration of the duality of a woman's nature. Now, I've had a number of questions on my blog over the last few weeks and a couple of years from readers who have been with me a long time and who've stayed with me for throughout that entire period about what do I do about women in the current era? They are so trashy, so unpleasant, so destructive, so difficult to deal with. And the answer in the game literature is really not sufficient. It's not. Because the answer in neo-masculine or game or pickup-oriented literature is always the same. Be alpha. Be strong. Be tough. Anytime you meet a woman who doesn't satisfy your needs for quiet, drama-free life, ditch her ass, move on. If you look at post-Christian so-called alpha male 2.0 types like Black Dragon, that's exactly what he advertises his lifestyle. Now, there's good reason to be deeply skeptical of a guy like Black Dragon. I wrote a post, I think called back in January of 2019, called Chasing the Black Dragon. And it was in response to this internet flame war which was going on between Krauser, who's a famous English pickup artist, and he emphasizes day game a lot, and Black Dragon, who emphasizes online game. So Krauser basically said, Black Dragon's full of shit. There's no way that he is who he says he is. He lives in Portland, which is one of the shittiest places in America for beautiful women. And he's right. Krauser is right about that. And he is ripping guys off. He is selling them a bill of goods. It doesn't work. What he's doing doesn't work. What he's proposing doesn't work. And so on and so forth. And I said that there's a lot of reason to take Krauser's argument seriously. Black Dragon responded and he said, look, if you really are skeptical about me, then just look at my results. Talk to the guys who have worked with me. Talk to the people who know me and, and judge based on what you see of the people who have bought into my philosophy. Everything I write is out there. It's on public record. You can look at my history for 10 years and you can analyze for yourself whether or not I'm right. But then if you actually look at a video of Caleb Jones, the guy who goes by the moniker of Black Dragon, you can find videos of him at the 21 convention and other places. And the guy is fat. I'm not trying to make him ashamed of himself or anything. That's not my intention. But the guy is very clearly fat, overweight, puffy, not attractive looking, and so on and so forth. And he makes all these claims about being super successful, sexually very successful, having a great business and so on. I believe the part about having a great business. I don't have a problem with that. But when you look at what he says and you look at the incongruity between what he writes and the common sense interpretation of it, the guy says he has, the woman must be 40 something now. She's an easily an 8 or a 9. She's super successful career woman. She's totally cool with his non-monogamous lifestyle. She is okay with the idea of experimenting with other women in the bedroom, together as a couple, and, like having threesomes and such. I'm sitting there going like, something's not making sense. And Black Dragon himself was raised in a Christian environment. He has a son to whom he is not biologically related from his first wife, and so on and so forth, who is not even of his race. And, you know, there are lots of incongruities which add up to paint a picture of a guy who isn't an alpha male in any way. And you see this incongruity, and you ask yourself, well, do I really want to be taking advice from this guy? I'm not saying you shouldn't, because in all honesty, I mean, speaking even as a Christian, I can tell you, some of the things Black Dragon says are absolutely true. I mean, he sees a different aspect of the truth than maybe the rest of us do, and that's fine. It's his interpretation of it. What he chooses to do with it is up to him, but we are also free to accept or reject his advice if we see fit. I'm not bagging on the guy. I'm not bagging on any pickup artist. I'm not trying to tell you that they're bad people or anything. I'm trying to tell you that these are not people you should necessarily model your life around. Then again, I'm not somebody you should model your life around either, so what do I know, right? But the thing to understand about what they say about women is that they only see part of the truth. They only see the part that is destructive. And they only respond to the part that is destructive by advising men to adopt habits that are sometimes constructive and sometimes highly destructive. The idea, for instance, that a man should be out there and dating a lot and fornicating a lot is incredibly destructive to a man's soul. That's not what you should make as your priority in life. I don't agree with the MGTOW crowd either when they say that you should just abandon women completely because they're too destructive. That's the wrong impulse. Okay, looking at it from a Christian perspective, a woman is both a civilizer and potentially a civilizer and potentially a destroyer. Okay, if you look throughout the Bible at women and at the examples given of good women, of virtuous women who build men up, who create good things out of men, what do you see? You see examples such as Abraham's wife, Sarah. Now, Sarah was not completely good. I mean, she was barren for most of her life. And she advised Abraham to go in onto, you know, onto her handmaid and so on and so forth. But she was also blessed in life, very late in life with children. So, Sarah herself was in many ways a good woman. That's an example of a woman who helped build her man up, who helped support him, and who helped create something good in his life. The quintessential example of the ideal feminine woman is Mary, mother of the Lord, Jesus Christ. Would Jesus have been what he was and what he is without Mary? No. Because Mary provided the loving, caring, supportive, nurturing role that a son needs. Jesus became who he became in large part because he was human. And he understood humanity through the eyes of his mother and father, who were flawed and fallen, as all men and women are. He had great sympathy and empathy for them. Mary helped build her son into what he became. And Jesus was not alone in his mission. I mean, he had brothers that the Bible implies that Joseph and Mary had biological children, sons of their own. And the brothers of Jesus were present throughout his life and his ministry and witnessed his crucifixion. That's implied in the Bible. What happened to them afterwards, I don't believe is mentioned at all. I could be wrong. you know, again, not a good Christian here, so don't take my word for any of this. Go look it up yourself. If you think I'm wrong, you know, say so. I mean, criticism is welcome. Just say it. But the civilizing aspect of women is given over and over and over again in the Bible, and it's made clear how important that is for a man to be restrained, for his more destructive impulses to be restrained and calmed and tempered by a good woman. This is the ideal of marriage within a Christian framework. A man marries a woman, and as the Bible makes clear, as Paul makes clear in his epistles over and over again, whether it's in 2 Corinthians, whether it's in, I believe, Romans, whether it's in Ephesians, I think even maybe even Galatians has it. Again, like I said, don't take my word about Scripture. I could be wrong. Go look it up for yourself. But he makes it clear over and over again. The role of a woman is to submit to her husband, and importantly, very importantly, this is the part which everybody forgets when bashing Christians, the role of a husband is to be gentle with his wife, to accept her as the weaker vessel, to be sympathetic with her emotions, to stand firm as the rock when she inevitably goes crazy. And, you know, a lot of guys these days have a hard time accepting what women are like. They are more emotional. I mean, it sounds, I'm well aware that this sounds like I'm telling the blindingly obvious that women are more emotional. They are. But here's the thing. You actually have to see and watch a woman in full emotional meltdown, which I have, to understand how bad it can be. And it can be truly bad. It can be really, really scary if you're not used to it. I grew up in a family where such meltdowns were totally discouraged. It didn't happen. And I thought in my naivety that that's how relationships work, because I'd never seen anything else. So when I finally started having relationships of my own, I was totally unprepared for women who would, at the drop of a hat, go completely berserk over small little things. I was like, you know, why are you getting upset about this? This is not worth getting upset about. It's not a big deal. But to whoever was, in, you know, whoever the woman was, to her it was a huge deal. And that is where the destructive element of a woman's nature comes in. And that's the part that most men have enormous trouble dealing with. Women can be incredibly destructive of a man's peace of mind, calm, and psychological stability. And that's part of the reason why Paul said pretty clearly in the epistles, you know, it'd be good if all men were as I am. Now, Paul himself was married. Well, back when he was Saul of Tarsus, he was one of the Pharisees. Paul was married. He had a wife. He probably had children. Because you couldn't be a Pharisee as a Jew. You could not be among the Pharisaical council, or among the Pharisaical body, as it were, unless you were married and you had very strong command of the Old Testament. So when Paul said these things, that was a remarkable statement from a man who had been married and did understand the Jewish conception of marriage, which is fundamentally very different from the Christian one. The Jewish conception does not treat divorce as a mortal sin. It doesn't. It doesn't say that divorce is a tragedy. It's not something that makes God weep. Okay. The Jews believe that divorce is a tragedy. It's unfortunate. It's really painful. But you know what? It's between the man and the woman to sort out. And if the rabbi wants to or needs to get involved, then he gets involved as the lawgiver. But it's not a tragedy. It doesn't make God cry. They view the Christian understanding of divorce as heretical. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why Jews really don't like Christians who try to preach to them. Jews believe that Christianity is a heresy of their faith. So the next time you hear somebody talking this nonsense of Judeo-Christian, that's bullshit, okay? Shut them down. It's bullshit. There's absolutely no compatibility between the two religions, except in the fact that Judaism, as written in the Old Testament, which is not Judaism today, but Judaism as written in the Old Testament, is the primogenitor of Christianity, except for the fact that Jesus Christ himself, the Lord and King, was a Jew by birth, except for the fact that Jesus was descended from the line of David by birth through his mother, and that Joseph, his father, was also a distaff descendant of the line of David. So basically, Mary and Joseph were very, very distant cousins. And that's well known. I mean, that's been established in the Bible. And except for the fact that the God of the Old Testament is the father of Jesus, you know, and Jesus Christ of Nazareth. It's easy to say that there are two different gods in the Bible. No, there's not. There's a reason why the God of the Old Testament is fundamentally very different from the God of the New Testament. You know, the God of the New Testament is loving and forgiving and so on. But remember that the reason why all this happens is because in the Old Testament, in like the reason there's this very sharp distinction and division is because the New Testament is the completion of the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, the Lord takes a very active role. He's a very, very vengeful and direct God. But in the New Testament, that same God takes a big step back, and we see everything pretty much through the eyes of Jesus or through the life of Jesus and through the eyes of his disciples. Okay? So we're a step removed from God. And make no mistake, God is very angry and vengeful in the New Testament. He's very angry at what happens to his son. He's infuriated by what he sees as the injustices. Well, they are injustices, because if he sees them as injustices, they are injustices. Inflicted upon the Gentiles and the Jews upon the followers of his son. So, make no mistake, the vengeful, wrathful, angry God of the Old Testament is very much present in the New. It's just that we don't see him as much because we take a big step back. We look at everything through the eyes of Jesus' disciples, and we look at everything through the life of Jesus. So that whole, you know, raining down hellfire, well, no, excuse me, not hellfire. My apologies. That's wrong. Raining down death, damnation, destruction, horrors, plagues, and so on, all of that scary stuff in the Old Testament. That doesn't happen so much in the New Testament, but make no mistake, it's there. I mean, in Acts, for instance, or just before Acts, there's a massive earthquake. There's darkness upon the land of Israel. It's a massive earthquake that shakes the walls of the city of Jerusalem, and cracks appear. The veil that separates the Holy of Holies in the temple is torn in two, from the top to the bottom. Which is, that shouldn't happen, but that's what happens. The veil is torn in two from top to bottom. All of this stuff is the sign of a God who is enraged by what has happened, by what has been done to his beloved son. And all of the stuff that you read in the book of Acts, and eventually in the book of Revelations, makes it very clear that the vengeful and angry God is still very much there. Okay. Now, turning back to this idea of a woman who civilizes and a woman who destroys. As I said, the Bible is replete with examples of women who civilize, and the way in which a woman civilizes a man is very clear. A woman civilizes a man by making him less angry, less temperamental, more patient, more kind, more accepting, more deserving of trust, more willing to accept different points of view, more interested in doing things that maybe he wouldn't be interested in doing on his own. Because he wants to be gentle with her. He wants to be kind to her. He wants to participate in her life. And ultimately, he wants to have children with her. That is why marriage is referred to as the manifestation of hope. And children are the manifestation of love. Now, this is a very wonderful and rosy picture of marriage and of, you know, male-female relationships. And Christians, I think rightly, get a lot of stick from non-Christians about how ridiculously optimistic that is. And I think that's fair. I actually do think that's a fair assessment. Because when you hear it put in terms like that, and then you look at the reality of marriage and how difficult it is, and how many marriages devolve into passionless, just two people, two friends hanging out, spending time together, but they have no passion for each other, no desire, no interest in one another. When you watch that, when you see how so many marriages break down, how stubborn men are, how, even among Christians, how difficult it is for Christians to stay married, and how unpleasant some of those marriages can be. You know, it's easy to say that Christians don't know what they're talking about. But that's where the destructive element comes in. And I'm not absolving men of our responsibilities in marriage at all. That's not the focus, that's not the point of this podcast. The point is to look at what women can do in a marriage, and how important it is to pick the right one. The destructive element of women is also narrated very clearly in the Bible. I mean, the story of Samson and Delilah stands out very clearly. You fall for the wrong woman, and oh boy, you're in deep shit. You know, she will rob you of all of your strength. She will take away everything you have. She will result in your destruction. If you look at the Jezebel spirit as outlined in the Bible, what did Jezebel do to Ahab? She led him completely astray and destroyed all the good works that he did, and was eventually stoned to death, I think, or something like that. I don't know. She was pushed out of a window or something. I mean, my memory of the details is fuzzy. But every woman has those two aspects in her of the woman who civilizes, who creates a good home and a good family and a happy, happy, abundant, wonderful environment, calm, serene, you know, enjoyable for a man to be in. And the destructive side, where she tears a man down, you know, destroys his peace of mind, his tranquility, his calm, his ability to maintain any kind of relationship with the outside world. And increasingly in the West, what we're seeing is that second spirit, the Jezebel spirit, which has infected women up and down, you know, throughout the Western world and throughout much of the world in general. How do you solve that problem? Well, as I said earlier, the advice from the neo-masculine types, from the game types, from the alpha male 2.0 crowd, from up and down the manosphere, is not necessarily the best. It says, be alpha, kick her out. If she causes you trouble, move on to the next one. Okay, that's good advice up to a point. But it works only if your end goal is fornication. If your end goal is marriage and stability, you need to be much, much more discerning than that. You need to be so discerning that you basically rule out almost every woman that comes across your path. What do you have to do? Well, the ideal, as presented in the Bible, is to go to find a woman who is deep in Christ and deeply involved spiritually, emotionally with the Holy Spirit, to the point where you actually kind of almost have to go through God to get to her. That sounds like an impossible task, but it also seems to be the only way to find a woman who's willing to be submissive enough to be a good woman, to be a good wife. Otherwise, as a man, you may well be condemned to stay alone for the rest of your life. Now, is that good advice for a man? Probably not. The reality is that God engineered men to be very horny. That's just the truth. As unpleasant and as unpalatable as it might sound, God engineered men to be extremely horny and to seek to spread our seed as far and wide as possible. And God engineered women to be very, very picky. But God also created conditions in the fall, you know, from paradise, from the Garden of Eden, where women would turn out to be contentious and difficult. So when you see women acting the way they do, of, you know, blowing up marriages and being impossible to live with and being insanely demanding and constantly testing a man, constantly trying to undermine his authority. And this happens even in Christian marriages, by the way. This is not unique to any particular group or, you know, set, or race or tribe or whatever. Every woman seeks to do this at some level, some unconscious level. Why is that? Well, go back to Genesis chapter 4 in the fall from Eden. What did the Lord say to Eve? Well, what he said was, I'm paraphrasing. Well, no, you know what? I'm not going to paraphrase. I'm going to go look it up right now. So, Genesis chapter 4, chapter 3. My bad. Chapter 3. To the woman, this is Genesis chapter 3, English Standard Version, Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. To the woman, he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you. Now, that's the English Standard Version translation. It's also this line, your desire shall be contrary to your husband. It is also translated as, or shall be toward your husband, because in Genesis chapter 4, verse 7, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. Now, there's a lot of controversy within Christian circles about this translation, because it sounds as though, if you use the toward translation, that a woman desires her husband. Just desires him. But that's not what we see in everyday behavior. That's not what it's like when women contend with their husbands, when they try to destroy him, they try to tear him down. That's not how we observe, you know, women getting into fights with their man on the street, going crazy, going berserk, beating the shit out of him. I mean, roughly speaking, anywhere between 40 to 60% of domestic violence cases in the U.S. are actually instigated by women. Let's be clear about that. This is, you know, you cannot absolve women of their guilt. And if you look at the West, you know, the idea is you must believe all women. Women are always the victim. No, they are not. Women are involved in instigating many of the same abuse cases, violence cases, and so on. The situation is sometimes even worse in Russia. In Russia, for instance, they don't actually... Putin signed a decree into law basically decriminalizing a lot of domestic violence and abuse cases, examples of domestic violence. And Russia does have a serious problem with domestic violence. But here's the thing. The Russian attitude toward domestic violence is radically different from the Western or European attitude. A lot of Russians take the view that if a man strikes his woman, it's because she did something to deserve it. I don't condone that. I don't agree with it. But there are times when a woman in Russia will attack her husband, will actually physically assault her husband or her boyfriend. That, too, is normal to Russians. Russians are like, it's okay for a woman to just beat the shit out of her boyfriend. that to them is normal. And that's part of the reason why I said earlier in this podcast, the Russians have a number of serious cultural problems, even though they've been Christian for 1,000 years. This is part of it. This is part of their culture. A woman beating the shit out of her man is, I wouldn't say necessarily common, but it happens much more frequently than you might think. A man beating the shit out of his woman is unfortunately very common. Again, this is a Christian society. So the destructive element of a woman's nature is given in the Bible, and it comes down to that mistranslation of your desire shall be contrary to your husband, or shall be toward your husband. There's another translation, which I think is the New Living Translation or something like that, which basically says something very different. If you look at, let's see, the New Living Translation. What does the New Living Translation say? The New Living Translation says, "And you will desire to control your husband, but he will rule over you." All right? Now compare that with the Living Bible, which says, come on. The Living Bible, whenever it pulls up, I'll tell you what it says. But if you look at the Living Bible, it says, blah, blah, blah. You shall welcome your husband's affections, and he shall be your master. Right? So the Living Bible has a very weird translation, which is, you know, that doesn't make sense compared with other translations. If you look at the King James Version, you know, the gold standard, if you look at the King James translation of this particular passage, the King James Version says, "And unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Okay. Of these various translations, only the New Living Translation actually gets it right, interestingly enough. Women have, in their nature, a desire to control and dominate their men. That's where the destroyer aspect comes in. Women also have a desire to love their men. That's where the civilizer aspect comes in. Your job as a man is to find a woman who is more civilizer than destroyer. You will never find a woman who is free of the destructive impulse. Your job as a man is to control that destructive impulse. How do you do it? Okay, this is where some of the advice from, not the pickup artist crowd, because the pickup artists don't know a damn thing about how to manage relationships. I mean, just look at the history of pickup artists. You look at Neil Strauss. I mean, that guy is divorced now, and he wrote a book, basically, in which he renounced his pickup artist ideals or ways. So, you know, taking them seriously, I don't advocate it. If you look at Richard LaRuna, who wrote The Natural, I haven't read it, it's on my book list, but he is happily married to a Russian girl, and he's been married for, I think, 5-6 years. He has distanced himself from PUA. Why? Because he found monogamy and happiness. And he had to do a lot of hard work to make a man out of himself. If you look at a lot of other PUAs, pickup artists around the world, they've either given up on pickup or become monogamous themselves or settled into a life of celibacy or gone MGTOW. The alpha male approach is monogamy, fidelity, and chastity. Now that sounds weird, you know, because alphas are known for their sexual promiscuity, and that's true. But the true alpha approach is to love your woman, not pander to her, not bow to her, but to be strong in the face of her tempests. This is enormously difficult. I can tell you from first-hand experience, it is immensely challenging to be strong and centered and not want to run away and flee and just say, you know what, I give up on this, she's crazy, she's impossible. I've experienced this with Slavic women, which is, you know, there are many wonderful things about Slavic women, but their tempers are not one of them, and their lack of control over their tempers is a problem. I wouldn't, one of my readers, Dire Badger, says that redheads are basically women on expert mode. To be with a redhead, you have to, that's expert mode dating and marriage. And I believe him. I would say Slavic women are hard mode. Not expert mode, but hard mode. Especially if you don't have a lot of experience. So, if you want to date a Slavic woman, yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I honestly think life is better with them in it than without them. But just be warned that you're going to be faced with a lot of tests. But, women in general, and Slavic women in particular, want a man who is just going to stand there and take their abuse and help them to calm down by presenting them with emotional love and acceptance of their feelings. And that doesn't mean that you just say sorry all the time, because that's ridiculous. That's weak. That's awful. What that means is that you kind of have to accept a wave of abuse, at least at first. And then you have to point out, no, that's not okay. You can't do that. That's not acceptable. And you have to do that after presenting some form of acceptance and stoicism in the face of the tempest. Once that tempest is passed, once that destructive impulse is finished, that's when the civilizer comes into play, because that's when the civilizing aspect of a woman really begins to flower and blossom. And it's hard to get to that point. It's very hard work. It's very challenging. It's challenging for anybody. It's, Christian or otherwise, it's immensely difficult. So when guys say, I'm looking for a good wife, a good woman, whatever, well, yeah, fine, but you have to do a lot of hard work on yourself, because the thing about a woman is when she tries to civilize you, she's doing that with her, from a woman's perspective and point of view. That's not a bad thing, but you yourself also need to be an adult before you get to that point, and that's very difficult. That's very, very difficult to get to that point yourself. Most men will never get to that point. Most men will never reach that level where they are confirmed adults, where they have died to everything that is within them, that is holding them back from fulfilling God's desires for them. Most men will never get to that level, that stage where they are indeed adults and they can accept adult responsibilities. And that's what you see in the modern world. You see women who have a desire to civilize but are only destructive, and men who can't stand up to that destructive impulse and are only interested in kind of playing with toys and being childish. And that's a big part of the reason why the world is the mess that it is today. Anyway, we're coming up on the 1 hour mark, and I could keep going on about this for a long time, but I've rambled on quite enough already. And I've presented a lot of information, not necessarily in the most structured way, I admit. But there's plenty to chew on and digest. So, as I said, don't take my opinions on Christianity seriously. I am a very bad Christian myself, so don't for a moment think that I have a handle on what I'm talking about. Be skeptical, be inquisitive, look into what I have presented, look into Hinduism, look into the article by Richard Grenier, which is going to be the long read of the week in tomorrow's Great Monday Dak Browser Buster, and I'll link to it in the description box of this podcast. You can read through it for yourself and understand what I'm saying about Hinduism. You can read my post about chasing the black dragon and come to your own conclusions about what Krauser is on about, what black dragon is on about. You can go look up what I've said about the Bible and the Watchers and so on and so forth. You can go look up what I've said about domestic violence in Russia and in the US. By all means, try to keep me honest, because the last thing I want to be doing right now is talking out of my ass and not presenting you guys with, at least as far as I can tell, the truth. So. Many thanks for listening in. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 34, The Civilizer and the Destroyer.